session number 22631 for Reel 2.
Of her, but I don't remember hearing about her.
No, she was born in 33, mm-hmm. So she was nine in 42.
I mean, she always had photographs of her, but and they would talk about her if she had any news, but I think I suppose we looked on her main role as being looking after us. Yes.
Tell me about Rangoon.
Well, we had static canteen there, but we were there, called out when the prisoners of war were being flown out from the railway, the death railway, and we were. This was their sort of first bit of freedom of being feeling that they were free, and they were all sort of rather dazed, and they were of course incredibly thin and sort of wearing tattered clothing and so on, and the idea was to take it very easily and gently for them. So they had time when they got off the plane, and there was this sort of reception committee for them, but we were also doing the tea and cakes, and which was quite, of course, they weren't expecting to see women, and was quite a shock for them. I mean, some of them just wanted to come and talk, and others were afraid of talking to them. So, you know, we were an unknown, so it was all too much for them, that everything was too much for them to take in. And it really was, one felt to have been able to have done that and provided it. I was given, for the officer in charge of clothing stock had said, in case any of them haven't got any sort of clothing or shoes, give you a supply of capes and shoes, you see. Well, of course, they were in the most terrible condition, most of them, and we gave them our capes and shoes and say, well, tomorrow we want some more. Well, we said, you're not supposed to give them out unless, you know, unless they really are in a bad way. They've got sort of recent clothes. We can't just go on giving them out army capes so I said, well, I find it rather difficult to know, to decide. Would you perhaps come out with us tomorrow and sort of say who you see? Well, of course, by the end of it, when he saw these people, I mean, he was giving away right, left and centre, you know. I mean, it was such a terrible, they were in such terrible shape. Mm. And then they went down to POW camps, especially set up for them. We were told not to give them, to bring food, and I think we did, perhaps it was a sponge cake or biscuit, something, because they weren't used to eating. I mean, they had to adjust to eating other than just a sort of bowl of rice or whatever it was. So although we'd sort of had plans for taking a lot of goodies, they said, no, have to wait and see them all through medicals and so on and see how they are. So that was a great feeling of having done a good job there.
Mm. How long were you doing?
I suppose it was a matter of over about 3 weeks really that they were coming in.
Had you realised that was the extent of the suffering?
No, I don't think any of us had. I mean, we knew about the death railway, but we didn't know that they were anything like that condition. Mm. Mm. So that was.
That's amazing to see. Something I'll never forget. Have you met any since then?
No. Then, of course, they had to wait for rather a long time for there to be enough shipping, and it was the same with the British troops altogether, and again, I think in Rangoon, our static canteen was very important because people did get bored, and also there was the feeling of why so-and-so, why have they got been repatriated before we have. And there was some feeling, unfortunately, about prisoners of war, you know, that why should they be, you know, by the time they were beginning to sort of fill out and look all normal, that they should sort of take their turn. So whatever decisions came up with, there were always a lot of disgruntled people who weren't getting their demob fast enough. So I think that the static canteens were somewhere for them to go, and they played cards and card games, you know, and had tea, and whatever we provided in the way of food was an important bit.
Right.
As they were beginning to get, they were longing to get home.
Yeah.
Days, they weren't, there was a limit to what could be, how many white posts they could paint and things like that.
Yeah.
There was nothing much for them to do.
Yeah.
And then from there we went on to Japan. And that was first of, again, because of the lack of shipping. We were in Dulali Tap, outside Bombay for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then we went to Japan. We got there in March. And
March
45, would it be? 46. No, 46 it would be, yes, because it was August 45, isn't it? Yes, March 46. And again, we had static canteens attached to, we were attached to the 2nd Dorset Regiment. And then we went from there up to Matsui, which was in the beautiful part of northern Japan, with the Dorsets, and we did evening, we used to, rather as was done in Rangoon, we had sort of somewhere for them to come in the evening and play card games and have tea and so on. And we were in a Japanese house there, and we had a Japanese interpreter who used to come every morning because a Japanese cook cooked for us. And two Japanese girls who used to come and clean. So he used to come and give the instructions. And I was trying to, food was better there, saying to the interpreter about soup and how to make croutons, I was sort of saying, cut the bits of bread into small pieces and fry them, and the Japanese cook said, oh, crouton, and he'd worked in a French restaurant in Tokyo, so we sort of communicated in French cookery, culinary terms after that.
Fantastic.
And the two girls used to wait up for us. We didn't get back from the canteens until about 10:30 or 11. And I said to the interpreter, tell them they don't need to wait up for us. And so there was a long conversation where the girls were obviously very agitated, and he said, but this is what should be done. They should be there to meet the house, the master of the house, the mistress of the house coming back. So we continued with it because it upset them too much.
Mm.
They'd take our shoes off because we were in a Japanese house where you had matting floors.
How does it feel to be on enemy?
Well, it was very difficult, really, because when we arrived, actually, in Japan, the ships were supposed to be being unloaded by Japanese work teams, and they'd gone on strike or something. The New Zealand, we had New Zealand troops there. And they were doing the unloading, and that seemed so awful after all that time. And the more we went round, there was a very, very much in those days, maybe still, a distinction between the women and the men. And the women all sort of felt, I think, that when they saw the troops, our troops, you know, that as compared with the little Japanese men, you know, these great sort of 6 foot Scotsmen and so on, that it was not surprising we'd won the war, you know. But it wasn't. It was difficult to adjust to, I have to say. But then you see, when we saw Hiroshima, that I found an enormously difficult situation, that anybody could do that, human beings could. It was just flat, it was just rubble. And so, you know, I felt it was both of it was the nastier aspects of war.
Were you prepared to, before you went to Hiroshima, what you were going to see?
No, we'd no idea it was as bad as that.
What was it like? Do you mind telling me about it?
It was absolutely. I've got some photographs somewhere, and I haven't got them with that lot of photos. But it was just rubble, and there were two or three what had been sort of small tower blocks of flats or offices which had been built with in concrete and iron. You know, around struts down. They had just been twisted, as like a sort of child twisting a toy, a plasticine toy. But the rest was just rubble. And it happened in the morning when people were having their breakfast and going to work and so on. And so there had been a lot of devastation and fires and things. And it was eerie, really, because there was a bridge that just went halfway across the river, you know, and the rest of it has been blown away. It left a very big impression, I think. And of course, we didn't know then that it wasn't a very good idea to be paddling around in radioactive. I mean, at that stage they didn't realise the effects, you know, the lasting effects of radiation. But I survived till I'm 80, so it obviously didn't, nearly 80, so it nearly, obviously didn't do too much harm at the time.
What about the Japanese civilian population? What kind of contact did you have with them?
Not really, only where they were supplying sort of manpower to, as I say, like in Matsue, when they were doing the sort of more household tasks. It was difficult to look at them and believe that they could have created so much destruction, really. Or to come to terms with the cruel streaks. When we were on our way home, we had a month in Singapore. We had a waiting for the ship from Singapore to take troop ship to go back. And they were having war crimes trials, and two or three of us went to one of these, and it was not a very high level Japanese officer who was being tried, and one of the things that he was sort of accused was that when our troops were ill, they weren't given food because they were ill. And they said, but this is what our own troops, if our troops are ill and not able to fight, then we don't give them. You know, and they were quite bewildered about some of the things. An officer hitting a soldier, which would be quite acceptable in the Japanese army. Why were they being, you know, these things being picked out? But they didn't see the broader picture.
So how long were you in Japan?
From March until August.
Right, did Lynn come and see you there?
I don't think she must. She went to Jakarta and Sumatra. It may have been when I was in Matsui, because the rest were not Tokyo, but the naval port. I think she did come, but Kyoto, but I think she went, but I didn't see her, because we were up in Matsui and she didn't have, it was quite, it was a very long road journey and there wasn't anything much in the way of aircraft. But I'm sure she came, because she would have done, but I didn't actually see her.
So when did you go home?
August bank holiday 1946 would it be, wasn't that 46, yes. I mean, I arrived in England, well, we all were the ones who were being, six of us who were being demobbed together. We arrived in Liverpool, and one of them didn't get her luggage out in time, and there was a train waiting to take us to London. And we'd all come back with sort of trunks and bedding rolls and things. And so she missed the train because she was still waiting for one bit of her luggage. So when we arrived at Euston, having been absolutely spoilt as it was, that people would sort of rush and help you, I went to the movement control office and said, there's this luggage and will you look after it because she's coming, she'll be coming on the next train. They said, oh, no, it's August bank holiday, no, we haven't... We haven't got any space, no, too bad, you'll just have to wait, you know, and they couldn't care less. And then when they said, you could try the civilian bit, and they said, no, we can't do anything. So I had to sit feeling very uncherished, having had such a cherished, it made me realise what a cherished existence we'd had in the Wasps. I had to sit there for about 4 hours with her luggage until the next train came in, but I couldn't sort of leave it on the platform and go.
What a strange moment.
Yes, it felt very, very sort of, you know, hitting the ground.
Yeah.
Because one would always have had somebody who'd say, oh yes, we take it in for your wheel shift it or leave that to us.
Yeah.
You know.
And then where did you go?
And then my father had retired and they were down in Dorset and I went down there.
And did you work? Find work?
Yeah, I did a secretarial refresher course and got secretarial jobs.
What was it like here?
Well, it was again. It was very difficult to adjust to because there was still rationing in England, and we were given a demob thing. We were entitled to whatever it was, a coat and skirt and two blouses and whatever, so we could get those on coupons. But of course, it had been such a different life over in England, and you know, in a way, again, one felt one had been rather privileged. Apart from that bit of bombing in Akyab, we hadn't had the experiences they'd had of night after night of real heavy bombing, and all those years of rationing too. So it was quite difficult adjusting, I think. And it was still a time of a lot of hardship, but it was hardship that had been shared by people who'd been through it all, and it was a bit, and who find it a bit difficult to know what we were doing, mobile canteens in Burma, for goodness sake, what was that, you know?
That's interesting.
I mean, not in a nasty way, but just. Yeah.
No conception.
No, that's right.
That,
no.
Yeah.
Because it really had been the forgotten army.
Yeah.
Until the last bit.
Phyllis Jeffries. Father, his job was to go to America and talk to people in America about the war in Burma. Particularly following the peace in Europe. That was his job.
Yeah. getting there. And I think Mountbatten did a lot for us, because he got, he said, you think you're the forgotten army. Well, I have to tell you, you're not forgotten. Nobody's even heard of you. But I'm going to change all that. And he did, and he improved on things, because before that, that was when, 1942, the letters from home and so on had taken ages, and the equipment was slow and everything, and mm-hmm. he used his influence to make sure mm-hmm. that they had better fighting weapons, and mm-hmm. the posts were hurried up and things, and they were all important for morale. So it wasn't, but it was, they were still an awful long way from home, and it was a very different kind of war. Mm. But I don't know, I don't think there were any other. It was one of the, yes, one of the things was the, towards the end, when we were in Imphal, so it must have been fairly early on, ENSA, the entertainment troops, and we had various people came out to give shows, and we had Vera Lynn came to sing, and we had Gert and Daisy, and we had, there were various entertainers who came out. And Vera Lynn, we were down in Dimapur then, which was sort of railhead, terrible, hot, steamy, sort of rusty coloured water. And we were given a whole lot of, they said they billet her with us, and they'd supply some extra tins of food and things. And this, all these tins of stuff that we'd never saw in the normal way, you know, we thought, lovely, we'll never get through this while she's only going to be there for a week or 3 or 4 days, and we shall do well out of this. But of course everybody came to see her, so it was all finished, you know, everybody came to see Vera Lynn. So we didn't.
Was she a nice person?
Yes, I think she was rather too much organised by her agent who was with her, who sort of told her when she could and couldn't sing, or, you know, shouldn't sing. And I think there was a feeling that she could have, which she probably would have liked to have done, but she just felt she had to do what the agent said. She didn't sort of sing, even she sang a few lines on the hospital wards and things, but she was sort of saving her voice for the evening concert, you know. I mean, she was a very nice, warm, genuine person, but I think that she didn't, and Gert and Daisy would have done what they wanted without, I mean, they were much older, but they put on an enormous number of shows, and then they wouldn't be told what to do, I think, but she rather gave in to what she was told, and I don't think it was good advice. Because the hospitals are, of the casualties from Kohima were filled with a lot of very, very badly hurt. Mm. Who just, you know, it was England and somebody coming out and would have done, could have liked a few more lines. But I'm being a bit hard on her, I think. She was very nice. She's done a lot since.
Yeah.
Mm. So.
Mm.
And yeah, it was quite an effort to provide some sort of entertainment, and we used to have troops concerts and shows and funny men and so on. And we used to go to some of those, and if there was anything sort of slightly double entendre, Oh, they all used to look at us to see whether we were laughing or not, you know, whether we knew what the other meaning was.
Did you make lifelong friends, or in your husband, did you make people?
Yes, there are two or three people I still see and keep in touch with, and enjoy the lunch and club meeting up with some of them.
Mm. Yes, that's nice. You were there for a long time, in fact. You're away from home, it seems. For about 8 years, 7 or 8 years. Mm. And you haven't seen your parents since then?
I did have. Well, as far as the Wasp was concerned, yes, 42 to 46. But I did have one leave. You just thumbed a lift with the nearest RAF. Lots of said anything going to Calcutta, and they said yes, be on the airstrip by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and you just sort of sat in amongst the freight and got a lift to Calcutta, and then the same going back again.
Right.
Is
that once?
Yeah, it's the only once I remember going. Mm.
Gosh.
I don't know how long I had, 3 or 4 weeks maybe.
Sounds as if you're a very key person in the Wasps. Like many of you, you've worked for 4 years, weren't there?
No, I think I was one of the, according to the book, which I think does in chronological order, I was one of the earlier ones.
Mm.
And joined, as I say, at the same time as Phyllis Jeffries. And stayed on to the end, which some of the people didn't. People got married or their husbands came back. So,
You mentioned...
Yeah, I got a mention in dispatches, but I think it was a sort of good service, and long service and good conduct medal, really.
Oh,
I mean, it was nice to have. It was very nice to have, but we weren't... Well, I suppose we were doing quite dangerous work, but it didn't feel like it, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, what other people see as worthy of commendation, because you enjoyed it.
You sort of think of mentioning dispatches as somebody sort of rescuing a gun crew or something. It wasn't quite like that.
But we've had some marvellous letters from in response to Mother's advertisement in Dakar.
Mm. Yes, I didn't see that. Mm.
And she's, we've had men writing to us who remember you.
Mm.
Here at work. They haven't mentioned your name, but they remember Wasby's serving them and how an amazing thing it was to see women coming through the jungle and serving out tea and all that. It's brilliant. I mean, that's fantastic, because it's the other side of the story.
Yes.
To see that appreciation.
Yes.
So what we were hoping to do is to, in time for this October's lunch, to put something in interim together so that you can see the sorts of things that we're getting, we've had in.
I'm sure we used to get letters ourselves. I haven't kept any. We used to get letters when people were leaving, sort of saying when they were moving out of the area, just sort of saying how lovely it had been to see the Wasby canteen come round the corner, you know.
Isn't that brilliant? Can I use all the...
Yes, please do. Oh, I meant to put a towel.